This is a Pacifica Peace Watch special for Friday, May 23rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On June 2nd, the Federal Communications Commission, led by Chairman Michael Powell, the son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, will likely vote to ease media ownership caps in the U.S. Regulations currently in place limit the number of television stations a network may own or whether a company can own a newspaper and a television station in the same city. Critics of the FCC's proposal to change the rules predict that the changes will be swift and dramatic, permanently altering the media landscape across the country and further decreasing Americans' access to a diverse range of views and opinions, essential to the existence of a healthy democracy. The two FCC commissioners opposed to changing the rules are Democrats. Those favoring it are Republicans. Perhaps at no other time is an independent and diverse media more important than when the country is at war. Today on Peace Watch, we ask the questions, how does political bias influence war coverage? And how does that impact a citizen's right to know the truth and make an informed choice? Using the Middle East as an example, Robert Fisk, correspondent for the London Independent newspaper, discusses the differences in the way American and Europeans report the same story. Fisk spoke with Stephen Rohde as part of Peace Watch's continuing series, Clear and Present Danger, which explores the challenges of free expression in an open society.
Over the course of a quarter century covering the Middle East, can you describe the kinds of press restrictions you've been operating under at different times?
You know, I think we mischaracterize it with the word restrictions. In most cases, journalists turn up on assignments on major stories, certainly in the case of the American media, with a clear idea of what limits there are and what constraints there are. This, of course, particularly applies in the Arab-Israeli dispute, where the concern that a criticism of Israel, however soft and remote, will elicit an over-emotional response and the reporter will be accused of being an anti-Semite and so on, or a racist, has produced a situation in which journalists, American journalists covering the Middle East question, particularly new arrivals, are so sensitive and so careful of the way in which they report events, always putting the word alleged or reported around anything which might impugn the integrity of an Israeli army officer or indeed Ariel Sharon, the prime minister. Their reporting is almost unintelligible. I want to know what the reporter thinks, not what the Israelis and the Palestinians say. I know that. So, in a sense, once a major story breaks in the region, the restrictions are very much, you know, the front line runs through the mind of the reporter, I'm afraid to say. If you take the case, say, of the 1991 Gulf War, any journalist who remotely tried to question, I mean, I'm talking about American, I questioned it and the British press questioned it all the time, but anyone who questioned the motives of that war was immediately accused of being a Saddam lover, a man who obviously was for terrorism, who hated America, etc. Even worse was the reaction of September 11. I was actually crossing the Atlantic on September 11. Of course, my plane turned around when the US closed its airspace. And from the satellite phone in my seat in the plane, I was on deadline. I realized this is a Middle Eastern story. These must be Arabs doing this. They were. We didn't even know that then. And I wrote an 800-word story saying, so it has come to this, the lies of the Balfour Declaration, the promises of we made lies, the British to the Arabs, all the deceit of the decades, all the one-sided so-called peace processes, all the suffering of children in Iraq, I thought, and I said, seems to have produced this international crime against humanity, which is what it was. And the most extraordinary response to this, emails saying that I was in league with the devil, that I had a pact with bin Laden. A Harvard professor went on an Irish radio station saying that I was an evil, dangerous liar, that to be anti-American, whatever that is, and I suppose I was being accused of it, was the same as being anti-Semitic. In other words, if you criticize Mr. Bush, you become a Jew hater, a Nazi, a racist. Extraordinary attempt to any journalist, even British, to stop you asking why. American journalists, for example, could ask who and how they did it. That was acceptable. It was all right to say they were Arabs. They came from Saudi Arabia, most of them. But to then turn and say what's wrong with the countries they came from was absolutely forbidden. It was a no-no. It was a taboo question. Not for us. I mean, we kept pushing it through in the British press. But in America, it was unpatriotic to ask that question because it meant you're giving credit to terrorists. And so, by and large, journalists don't need restrictions. They restrict themselves in this country, I'm sorry to say.
Do you recognize a goal of objectivity? Do you see a distinction between writing commentary and what a reporter thinks and reporting facts?
I think we're dealing here with the problems of American journalism school, which, thank God, Brits don't go through. We do politics and history and other subjects at university. Look, I think that the foreign correspondent is the nerve ending of the newspaper. My paper sends a correspondent to live abroad to tell us what's happening there, not to tell us what two sides to a dispute are saying. We can read that on the wire. Over and over again, for example, when I'm in Jerusalem or Damascus or Cairo, I talk to my American colleagues who are just like me. They have the same job, much better salaries, of course, but the same basic role. And what they tell me is fascinating. They really have a deep insight, many of them, into what's happening in the region. But when I read their reports, it's not there. Everything that they tell me, which is of interest, has been erased. When they want to put forward a point of view, they ring up some guy in America who has very little knowledge, usually in one of the places I call the think tanks, the Brookings Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Rand Corporation, and this guy blathers on for two paragraphs of bland prose, and this is put in as an opinion. But I want to know what the reporter thinks. If you send a journalist to a region, and you send him because you think he's an intelligent, fair, decent reporter, you don't have to ask him to give 50% of every paragraph to each side. I mean, you know, if one follows the rules which journalists appear to have to obey in the Middle East, what do you do if you cover, say, the slave ship, the slave campaign, the slavery campaign? Do you give equal time to the slaves and the slave ship captain? If you're covering elements, say, you're covering events in the Second World War, do you give equal time to the prisoners and the SS guards? No. You have to have some sense of morality and passion and anger. You know, when I'm at the scene of, for example, the slaughter in Hama in 1982, where the Syrian army crushed the people of Hama, up to 20,000 dead, and destroyed their mosques in the old city, I managed to get in there, and my piece, if you read it now, drips with anger at the way in which this massive armed force run by the then president's brother was erasing a city and its history and its people. If you read my account of the Sabra and Shatila massacre carried out by Israel's allies in 1982, as Israeli soldiers watched, the same thing happens. You know, we should not be employed to be automaton, to effectively just be a voice for spokesman. We should be out there telling it how it is, as the old journalism used to be.
But if a sense of passion, morality and anger leads to a journalist like yourself being considered pro-Palestinian.
I'm not considered pro-Palestinian.
Do you
I'm not
ever hear that characterization, and does it undermine your credibility?
Absolutely not. Of course, Israelis who don't like seeing their misbehavior narratived into the paper, they'll say, oh, you're pro-Palestinian or pro-terrorist. Of course they do. And I have many times written about Arab misbehavior and immorality, and immediately I'm accused of being a Mossad agent. Indeed, I appeared at a conference in Boston called the Right of Return Conference, in which I criticized the corruption of Arab-American groups, in which I criticized their total dissociation from the actual dirt and filth of the refugee camps. And emails soon began to go around from various Arab students in the United States saying that I had been Judaized. This apparently was based on the idea that once a year, on average, I deliver a lecture at Madison, Wisconsin, arranged by a Jewish family, and that I was a member of Mossad. So you get it from both sides, and you have to take it. But if you see you want to be an uncontroversial journalist, and I'm not controversial, I'm a foreign correspondent on a mainstream newspaper, and I do my job. But if you're going to be frightened of people who use this cheap language, if you're going to write so carefully not to offend anyone, then you produce the pap that appears in the American media now.
Governments tell us they're protecting journalists by creating closed military areas, by restricting journalists from access to battle zones. Do you accept that?
Well, that's what the Soviets said when they labeled cities closed military areas in the Soviet Union. Look, during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, I learned very quickly that whenever the Israeli army declared a closed military area, it meant that they were doing something that they wished to be hidden. And every time they did that, I got into the town to see what they were doing. And invariably, there had been extrajudicial executions or tortures or prisoners taken away and not seen again or taken away to prisons like Hiyam. Exactly the same happens in the West Bank. The moment, for example, that they declared Bethlehem a closed military area, I'm talking about the first of the reoccupation of the West Bank by Sharon soldiers. I went straight into Bethlehem by a sidetrack, and I did the same in Ramallah. Our job as journalists, when we hear the words closed military area, is to go straight in because that's where the story is. It has nothing to do with our protection. Indeed, in the case of the Israelis, they've shot so many journalists and wounded so many journalists. The last thing I think they're interested in is the protection of journalists.
Have you ever written a story and looked back and felt you jeopardized civilians or soldiers or anyone by reading? reason of your story?
No, I'll give you a very practical example, and that's geography. It's very easy to do a color piece. As we walked up the hill, I saw a tank on the right. I always go through my copy afterwards saying, have I identified that hill? Because if I have, I'm giving a Palestinian or an Israeli or a Hezbollah a chance to get that tank. Of course, they know about it anyway. They know more about the military locations than we do. But I make sure that we're not even open to the accusation. If, by reporting, for example, the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, we are then accused of being anti-Semitic because we make people dislike Israel, well, I'm sorry, you know, that is not an argument I want to be involved in because my job is to report what I've seen. And, of course, when a country, Syria at Hama, for example, Israel at the time of Sabra Shatila, Iraq at Halabja, when a nation uses its armed forces and they behave in a despicable way which amounts to a war crime, well, it may be that our reporting makes people angry against that country. Well, tough luck. The country shouldn't commit these crimes.
There was great controversy in America when the entire tape of a Osama bin Laden broadcast was edited for American availability, but was broadcast in full on Al Jazeera. Mm. What is the role of the internet, of access to Al Jazeera and other news sources on Americans and people around the world getting a complete picture of what's going on?
Well, we haven't fully understood yet the implications of the internet. Once the internet allowed Americans to tap into English language newspapers abroad, not just The Independent, but The Guardian, The Financial Times, the French press, if they read French, or El País, which was very good, is very good in Spain, suddenly a new depth to coverage was given them. They were not reading in the English press what they were reading in The New York Times. I could tell immediately. I mean, at the moment, out of almost 1,000 letters a week, I'm getting more than 50% from the United States. Now, that is an indictment of the American media for a start. I should be getting 20% from America and 80% from United Kingdom. But in fact, more than half are coming from America, and many of them complain about what they refer to, as one did, the lobotomized coverage in the American press. Now, what is the effect of this? I think that more and more Americans are saying, hold on a second, why can't we read this in our newspapers? Why can't we watch this on our television? Yet again and again, even despite the fact, I don't think the American media realize the extent to which ordinary American citizens are looking at foreign publications, in itself an appalling reflection on the worth or lack of it of the American media. Continually, still, American reporters hedge their bets. I was reading an article which was referring to Sabra Shatila, for which the Kahan Commission in Israel said that Ariel Sharon was personally responsible, page 93, I think it is. And the article by the Associated Press referred to him allegedly facilitating the militias that went into the camp. A total cop-out. He was personally responsible. He sent the militias into the camps, where 1,700 Palestinian civilians were murdered. So I think what's happening is that with the internet, there's a profound change coming among Americans who are interested in the region, who have an intellectual interest or who are educated about the Middle East. Now, as opposed to all the other Americans who are not interested in the Middle East, I don't know. But certainly the internet is profoundly changing, I think, not fast enough, profoundly changing the way Americans look at regions which are not covered properly by their own newspapers and television.
We call our program Clear and Present Danger. What, from your perspective, is the clear and present danger to free press in the United States?
I think I'd sum it up very briefly. The relationship of the press and television to government is incestuous. The State Department correspondents, the White House correspondents, the Pentagon correspondents have set a narrative where instead of telling us what they think is happening or they know is happening, they tell us what they're told by the spokesman. They have become sub-spokesmen for the various great institutions of state. When American correspondents visit the Middle East, they turn up in Beirut or Damascus or Cairo, and where do they go? The first visit, the U.S. Embassy, for a briefing with the ambassador, the economic advisor, the defense attaché, and no doubt the CIA spook in some cases. Then they go and see an Arab minister of information, who, of course, never knows any information about anything ever. Then they write a story. Now, it's not always that bad, but that is the main theme which is followed. So what you have, I think, is a general consensus in America, which I hope is breaking up, that to challenge American foreign policy is in some way not just insensitive, but perhaps unpatriotic, especially foreign policy in the Middle East, which is still a taboo subject. You know, in America, you can talk about lesbians, gays, blacks, but not the relationship with Israel and the U.S. administration or Congress. So I think it is this cozy, incestuous, dangerous relationship between press and administration, between sources and access, that causes much of this problem.
Thank you, Robert Fisk, for joining us.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Robert Fisk, veteran Middle East correspondent for the UK's independent newspaper. He was speaking with host Stephen Rohde as part of Peace Watch's continuing series, Clear and Present Danger, which explores the challenges of free expression in an open society. The series is a production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones, the producer is Eileen Moskowitz, and the editor is Mark Torres. To obtain a copy, you can go to www.pacificaarchives.org. And to find out more about PEN USA, you can go to www.penusa.org. This is Memorial Day weekend, a time for reflection and remembrance when Americans commemorate those who have died in service to our country. Originally known as Decoration Day, it was founded in 1868 to honor soldiers killed in the Civil War. Since then, the holiday has become an observance of U.S. men and women missing in action and killed in all wars. Yet thousands of servicemen and women survive war and live with its emotional and physical scars. In the rest of today's show, we present this radio adaptation of Dalton Trumbo's famous novel, Johnny Got His Gun, originally produced by Charles Potter, Milton Hoffman, and David Rapkin for Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The protagonist is a wounded soldier lying in a hospital bed who slowly realizes the extent of his injuries. Listeners may find some images disturbing.
Oh, am I gonna hang over? Boy, I wish that phone would stop ringing. I'm not going to get up to answer that phone. I just wish it would stop ringing. That damn bell must be at the other end of the world. I have to walk for a couple of years to get to it. Or maybe somebody wants something bad. Telephones ringing at night are always important.
How can they expect me to answer that?
I'm tired. My head feels so big. I must have been drinking dynamite. Why doesn't somebody answer that goddamn phone?
Hello?
Hello, son. Come up home now.
All right, Mother. I'll be right there.
I gotta go home. My father just died.
Died? Died? Gosh, kid, that's too bad.
Well, I might as well go in. Mother, did you call someone?
Yes, Joe. They'll be here any time. I wanted you to be here first. It's them. Let's go into the kitchen.
Come on, sis. Come in.
Is Mrs. Bonham here?
Yes. They're coming. They're coming, Dad. I wanted to see you one more time before they take you away.
Thank you.
You look older than 51. But it's strange. Somehow, I feel older than you. I'm sorry for you, Dad. Things weren't going well for you. And they never would have gone well for you, and it's just as good you're dead. People have got to be quicker and harder these days than you were, Dad. Good night. And good dreams. I won't forget you. And I'm not as sorry for you today as I was yesterday. I loved you, Dad. Good night.
Cross his feet. Put the basket. That's it. Put the basket under his head.
I wonder if they're carrying the basket evenly down the stairs.
Okay.
Or if the head is lower than the feet.
Easy.
Or if it's in any way uncomfortable. If Dad were performing the same task, he would have carried the basket very gently.
That's not Bill. It may seem like him, but it's not.
No, Mom. I guess it's not. Everything's finished now.
Well, why couldn't everything be finished? How many times am I going to have to go through this? It's all over and finished, so why won't the goddamn phone stop ringing? So I have a hangover and I can't get up. Someone will answer the phone pretty soon. A hangover headache raises hell inside your skull. But this isn't any hangover. I'm a sick man. And you'd think the telephone would stop ringing sometime. It can't go on forever. I can't go over and over the same business of hearing the telephone ring and hearing my father's dead. Besides, Father could only die once. I'm drifting again.
I'm hurt. I'm hurt bad.
I was dreaming.
I wasn't dreaming.
I am awake, even though I can't see.
I'm awake, but I can't hear a thing.
I'm mighty scared. I remember when I was a kid, I read The Last Days of Pompeii and woke in the middle of the night crying in terror with my face suffocating in the pillow and thinking that the top of one of the Colorado mountains had blown off and thinking that my blanket was lava and I was entombed alive, but that I would lie there dying forever. My skin feels so hot and damp all over. And I can feel my bandages. They've wrapped me from top to bottom. Even my head.
Get down to those trenches, boy!
Oh, God. Am I deaf?
Where do they get all that stuff about bomb-proof dugouts? When a man in one of them could be hit so hard that the whole complicated business of his ears could be blown away, leaving him deaf. So deaf he couldn't even hear his own heartbeat.
I've been hit. I've been hit bad. And now I'm deaf. Not just a little deaf, not just halfway deaf. I'm stone deaf. So I'll never hear again. Well, there are a hell of a lot of things I never want to hear again.
I never want to hear the biting little castanet sound of a machine gun, or the high whistle of a 75 coming down fast, or the slow thunder as it hits, or the whine of an airplane overhead, or the yells of the dead trying to explain to somebody that he's got a bullet in his belly and that his breakfast is coming out through the front of him. Only nobody can help that soldier. They're so scared they can't even hear me.
The hell with it.
You wouldn't be a fool to jump off a rock that high.
I may be a fool, but what does that make you, Joe?
Oh, I don't know, Artie. But on a beautiful day like this, I can't think about anything but that green mesa over there across the way.
Dad says it's 11,000 feet in the sky with acres of columbines and the clearest mountain streams you ever saw.
Dad says it's 11,000 feet in the sky. Dad. Oh, Dad, you and Mom were so much in love. Dad, you used to tell me how you and Mom used the telephone when you were courting. That was when the party line ran just 18 miles along Coal Creek Valley and had only 5 customers. The phone was so new then that the farm 3 miles down the road suddenly seemed like it was next door.
Mary, is that our ring?
No, dear, it's the Anderson signal. I bet you a dollar it's Bill Bonham calling Charlie's daughter, Maisha.
I'll take that bet. Go on, pick it up and let's see who it is.
All right, I'll see who it is.
Hello, Maisha?
You lose, Bert.
Hello,
it's
Dad?
Him.
How are you?
I'm fine. Are you through with the work?
We just finished the dishes.
I suppose everybody is listening again tonight.
I suppose.
Don't they know I love you? You'd think that'd be enough for them. Maybe it isn't. Maisha, why don't you play something on the piano?
All right, Bill. Which one?
Whatever one you like. I like them all.
All right, Bill. Just wait till I fix the receiver.
Hey, Bert, she's gonna play the piano. Listening to you play. If it's all right, would you play after the ball is over? I know Bert would love to hear it.
Mary, ask Maisha to wait till I get to the phone.
Maisha, this is Sally. I'm here too.
And so am I.
We hope you don't mind all of us listening, but your music makes the end of the day seem so sweet.
Dad, didn't the people out in Coal Creek understand that it was a courtship and not a concert? Mom was playing that piano for you, Dad, before you died. Before you ever thought of me.
Charlie, since you're over at the counter, why don't you bring me one of those fine panatellas? You can put it on the tab.
Okay, Harry, coming up. Hey, what do you think the English did last month?
Couldn't say, but nothing that the English or the French do would surprise me anymore.
Me neither. Where it has it that the Russians are trying to push the goddamn Germans right back to Berlin.
And when they do that, it's the end of war.
They say Romania is going to enter the war. I don't even know where Romania is.
Oh, listen. I read in the paper that 2 young Canadian soldiers were crucified by the Germans. Crucified?
Oh, no.
Crap bastards.
Yeah. But those Romanian oil wells are sure going to help out the Allies. Between the English, the French, and the Romanians, the Germans are going to wish they never left Berlin. Yeah. And, you know... So they can't get away with this
then
forever.
Then father died, and America entered the war.
Right. They can't take over the world.
Oh, God, the This is no place for me. This is no war for me. This war wasn't any of my business. I didn't care anything about making the world safe for democracy. All I wanted to do was to live.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.